We're in the thick of the Democratic primary season, and while the popular vote in early states like Iowa and New Hampshire commands a lot of attention, the nomination really comes down to delegates. Those are the people who will vote at the Democratic National Convention this summer. A candidate needs a majority of them to carry the party's banner in November. And this year, the delegate rules are a bit different and more transparent. Last time around, many supporters of Bernie Sanders claimed the rules were unfair. Sanders himself suggested on MSNBC last year that he may have been cheated out of the nomination.
Some people say that if maybe that system was not rigged against me, I would have won the nomination and defeated Donald Trump. That's what some people say.
We're going to get into the new rules with James Roosevelt. He's an attorney and a Democratic Party official. He's the co-chair for the Rules Committee at the Democratic National Committee and will co-head the Credentials Committee at the DNC convention in Milwaukee in July. Hello there, James. Welcome to Radio Boston.
Hello, Callum. Glad to be with you.
We're glad to have you. So probably one of the most prominent changes was to the role of superdelegates in the nominating process. Can you explain the rule changes real quick and what was behind them? I mean, was this all about satisfying those concerns from Sanders supporters?
Yes. So the superdelegates, or the actual term in the rules is automatic delegates, are people who hold party or elected official offices who don't have to run to become a convention delegate. And moreover, they don't have to pledge themselves to one of the candidates to become a convention delegate. So in the past, they went into the conventions not necessarily pledged to a delegate, or they could have chosen to pledge to a delegate. And what the Senator Sanders is complaining about there is that when the automatic delegates went into the convention and were, and even before the convention, were allowed to announce who they were going to support at the convention, the press started counting those numbers, and that gave Secretary Clinton an apparent lead, even when she was not necessarily leading in the delegates chosen in the primaries and caucuses.
And the complaint about that, of course, is that it can promote this air of invincibility or inevitability and perhaps affect actual voting in primaries as it goes along, right?
That's correct. Now, by the time we got to the convention, in fact, Secretary Clinton had more delegates that had been chosen in primaries and caucuses. But who knows how those were affected by what people had been reading or hearing in the media about, as you say, the inevitability of Secretary Clinton.
So these superdelegates, James, they do still exist. They haven't disappeared, but they have a different role this time around in 2020. So what will their function be at this summer's convention?
That's right. After a very extensive process where we had 80 hours of public hearing and had recommendations from a committee composed of both Clinton and Sanders supporters, our Rules and Bylaws Committee that I co-chair recommended to the full Democratic National Committee a number of changes in the rules. One of them was that the superdelegates will not be allowed to vote on the first ballot. They can do everything else. They can go to they can be on the floor of the convention. They can be involved in the platform and the rules and so on, but they can't vote on the first ballot. If it should go to a second or more ballot, then they get to vote. But what that means is that when the Associated Press and CNN and so on do their tallies how many delegates a candidate has going into the primaries in the various states, those superdelegates can't be counted because they may never get to vote if it's decided on the first ballot.
And in fact, in most recent conventions, they would not have had an opportunity to vote under this format because usually we know who the nominee is going in. I'm almost reluctant to ask this because, you know, journalists love the idea of a brokered convention or an open convention, as it's called, but it does seem like an actual possibility this time around. So how would that work? I mean, if no candidate has a majority on that first ballot and we get to a brokered convention where all the delegates are released of their obligations, what happens then, James?
So I do like the term open convention or contested convention better than brokered, because brokered conjures up the bosses of past years making a decision in the smoke-filled rooms. And not only do we not have smoke anymore, we don't have bosses cannot, or another rule we have now is that they cannot pledge the people in their delegation. Everyone gets their own vote. But I do think an open convention, I mean, Nate Silver is saying it's somewhere between a 35 and a 50% possibility that we will have an open convention.
Nate Silver, of course, being the well-known political prognosticator who runs 538.
Right. That is appropriate. It means that a candidate that that starts late might have a chance. It means that if there is really a diversity of views in the party as the primaries and caucuses go along, maybe a convention is just what it's set out to be, a body that makes a decision on who will be the best nominee to represent the party's point of view.
In a sense, then, an open convention would be rather caucus-like. And I want to ask you a little bit about the first caucus that we had in Iowa, because, you know, all these rules changes were, I think, designed to help the process feel more transparent, feel fairer, to instill more faith in the process. And after all that, it really got off to an inauspicious start in Iowa. I think everybody would agree on that. Do you think that that damaged the credibility of the nominating process?
I think it has had a damaging perception here at the outset, and I'm hoping that will be overcome as we move along. But it was done, again, with full open consultation and at the particularly the urging of the of Senator Sanders supporters to make it more transparent. So the big difference, there are two big differences in the Iowa process this year from in the past. They wanted the same basic process, where they assemble, they talk among themselves for an hour or so, then they go to different corners of the room to indicate who they're for. And if some candidate doesn't have enough people in their corner, they can move to another corner for the second count. But the differences were that, first of all, the reporting of the vote was much more transparent. Now, it's been always necessary that there is a first count, so you determine who meets the 15% threshold to get any delegates at all, and then a second count after they rearrange or as they say, reallocate themselves. And those two numbers are what determine how many delegates that candidate gets in that county.
Which is how you can have sort of different results, right? We have the Sanders campaign pointing to what appears to be a popular vote win in Iowa, and yet Pete Buttigieg comes out with what appears right now to be a slight delegate lead. James, I do want to pick up on one thing you mentioned a moment ago while we still have time. You talked about somebody entering the race late, and of course Mike Bloomberg is the one who comes to mind there.
Although Deval Patrick could come to mind.
Well, that's true, but what Deval Patrick lacked, of course, was right. Mike Bloomberg's billions, and so I want to ask you about the role that money plays in the nominating process. A lot of Democrats aren't happy about the role that money can play in making a candidate come out of the field late and be relevant. Senator Elizabeth Warren of Massachusetts, for example, has complained about this. Here she is on MSNBC over the weekend.
I wasn't going to spend my time sucking up to the Michael Bloombergs of the world. I was going to do this grassroots.
So what do you think, James Roosevelt? I mean, is Mike Bloomberg buying the election? Is the DNC doing enough to limit the influence of money in the nominating process?
Well, I do think that first Senator Sanders and then along with him at this time, Senator Warren, changed the playing field by building a campaign fund built on small donations. However, there has the limitations on what can be spent are subject to federal law, not to rules we make in the party. And Senator Bloomberg is obviously Bear Bloomberg is obviously willing to spend a lot of his money, although as a percentage of his total money, it's not probably that much. But a lot of his money,
he can afford
the same way Tom Steyer is, apparently to a greater effect than Tom Steyer is getting.
You know, One of the things I want to ask you about is just, you know, the role of folks like yourself, sort of veteran party officials on these rules and credentials committees. I mean, you've, I'm sure, heard complaints such as those in The New Republic, the popular progressive magazine, saying that, you know, folks like yourself or Barney Frank just sort of form a, you know, an insider's club. You represent the establishment of the party, and that itself can erode faith in the fairness of the process for Sanders supporters and Warren supporters. I mean, what do you say to those concerns?
Well, the highest compliment I got in 2016, with all the recriminations that went on between the Sanders and Clinton campaigns and the DNC itself, of course, was that Jeff Weaver, who was Senator Sanders' campaign manager, and Larry Cohen, who was one of his chief strategists, came to me, said the one thing we found we could count on all the way along is that you and your co-chair were always fair to us. So that's our standard in the Rules and Bylaws Committee. That will be our standard in the Credentials Committee.
I do want to step back, James Roosevelt, while I have you on this President's Day, from talking about the immediacy of the 2020 race to just kind of a bigger picture. I mean, you are the grandson of President Franklin Roosevelt. How are you reflecting on his legacy today?
Well, it is kind of a great coincidence that we're having this conversation today. As someone pointed out in something I was reading earlier today, when I was growing up, we had both a Lincoln's birthday holiday and a Washington's birthday holiday. Then we combined them, and then someone decided to make it sweep in all presidents. And I do think honoring the office is a great thing. I'm not sure every single president is a person I would want to honor, but I am more than happy to have the opportunity to honor both my grandfather Franklin on the Democratic side and my great uncle Teddy on the Republican side.
You know, in recent years, I'm thinking back to the campaign of 4 years ago when the current president, before he was elected, Donald Trump, cited your grandfather's internment of Japanese Americans as a rationale for his Muslim travel ban. And we saw members of your family strongly condemn that. I mean, is that something you think about today, too? Sort of the mixed bag that goes with remembering the legacies of all presidents, including your grandfather.
Well, every president has a mixed bag of decisions that are made in moments of crisis, including, for example, Abraham Lincoln's suspension of the right of habeas corpus. And it's pretty clear now that President Roosevelt, Franklin Roosevelt, my grandfather, made a very serious mistake in ordering the internment of the Japanese. On the other hand, he was faced with an attorney general in California who said that the people of California could not be safe as long as that didn't happen. That Attorney General was Earl Warren, who was so popular because of it. In 1946, he received both the Democratic and Republican nominations for governor of California, was overwhelmingly elected, beat my father again in 1950, and then became an historic Chief Justice of the U.S. Supreme Court.
It's quite the history lesson. James Roosevelt, thank you so much for spending some time with us on this President's Day to remember your grandfather and also to talk about 2020 with us. James Roosevelt is an attorney and Democratic Party official. He is the co-chair for the Rules Committee at the Democratic National Committee. Happy President's Day to you, sir.
Same to you, Callum.